Welcome to the Athenaeum Review podcast. I'm Ben Lima, and we're very honored today to have with us Sean Hooks, who's an author and professor. He's contributed to Athenaeum Review in the past and in the near future, but we're going to start off by talking about the Roy Lichtenstein exhibition that's recently been here in Dallas. Sean, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, Ben.
So this Roy Lichtenstein exhibition is both at the Dallas Museum of Art and at the Nasher Sculpture Center. And it partly originated because there was the Roy Lichtenstein Foundation has donated works to a number of museums, including these. But I wondered if I could start by just asking what your impression was of this show and kind of what you saw and what your sort of take on it was.
Yeah, I think it's always interesting when, as a person who grew up very close to New York City, in New Jersey, and now living in Texas, it's, you know, and he is so associated with New York, and he's such a New York-y artist, and he's such a famous, well-known artist that people, even if you're not familiar with his work, you've seen his work, and you've, you know, kind of, it's in the cultural water to such an extent. And seeing this exhibit, you know, sort of his centennial, I guess, you know, he would have been 100, and to think that pop art is now that much, you know, a part of the past and simultaneously part of the present. And yeah, I think people kind of look at Dallas differently than they look at other major art cities. But one of the things, I've only been here since 2021, but with the museums like the DMA and the Nasher in Dallas and the Modern and the Kimball and Amon Carter in Fort Worth. Yeah, it's just, it's, they're really high level, world-class museums and galleries here. And it was, I found it to be sort of a magnificent exhibit of a master from his late period, you know, sort of the idea that most artists kind of mellow as they age. And I think in his case, there's an increase in intensity there. And the, you talked in your piece in the Dallas Morning News about just like the quality and the time that is obviously put into something, and pop art as something that's sometimes seen as dashed off or almost reactionary to the movement of abstract expressionism that came before it. But yeah, in Lichtenstein, I see sort of this recognizable figure in the art world that just sort of resonates, and the difficulty of the execution on some of those pieces and his ability to work on the canvas and in sculpture simultaneously just was sort of striking, you know. And it was, again, I was starting to think about like how he's grouped with Warhol and Richter, you know, again, it's not even challenging what came before it. It's just that sort of, I think we think that in the arts in general, in music, in literature, that periods sort of succeed each other.
Right.
Whereas, and Dave Hickey, the critic, has talked about this, especially in the arts, periods that succeed each other actually have nothing to do with each other. That's what's coming next is not an innovation on what came before or a refinement of what came before, but like the unfashionable opposite. And that pop and minimalism, which are two of my favorite movements, you know, we're sort of the opposite of abstract expressionism, which is also one of my favorite movements, you know, but that this idea that they don't necessarily share something, or that one, you know, it was not necessarily extruded from the other.
Yeah.
So yeah. And then just getting to be in two spaces, one at the DMA, one at the Nasher, with these vibrant, hyper colorful pieces of art that are sort of well known from books and pop culture, but to actually inhabit them, these three-dimensional objects in space, drives home a level of realism or reality even. And I know we've talked a bit about before about like having been teachers and working with younger people who are growing up in an internet age.
Yeah.
Where they're kind of bombarded by imagery. And I'm always trying to get my students to kind of think, you know, beyond the image. So when you look at Lichtenstein as like this image grounded artist, but there's so much more to it. There's my students are fascinated with the 80s and 90s, you know, most of them did not live through that. And I think it's because they were, to them, they were realer time.
Right. Yeah.
Because they were pre-internet or very, very early internet. And the online world, in a lot of ways, is, you know, is not real.
Yeah.
And that's why it's so essential to go out and inhabit these art spaces that the city of Dallas and some cities, many cities, then, you know, Texas for all of its, whatever we, without getting into Texas politics, a lot of money here is funneled towards the arts, you know, and we do have, you know, from West Texas all the way through Houston and Austin up here to the Dallas-Fort Worth area, we do have a lot of great art here, and we do have a lot of opportunities to actually sit or stand or gaze at things, masterworks in a room, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, I think that exhibition in particular was just like, yeah, like I get to see this a 15-minute, 20-minute drive from where I live. And then how people think of that as something you do in New York City by taking the subway. Yeah. And no, it's something you can do here. And yeah, I was so happy to see the Nasher and the DMA kind of team up for such, again, you know, I mean, it's hard to not use the word vibrant.
Yeah.
But yeah, vibrant art in particular, and art you can kind of walk around and perpend and think about. And I think that's in all the art forms, again, in music and literature, in the visual arts, works that can kind of make you think and rethink and reconsider and watch other people kind of engage with it from like Lichtenstein in particular is a work that like children can appreciate, highly educated people can, you know, appreciate, and the average museum goer can appreciate.
Yeah. Wow. No, that's, I mean, that I think there's so much. I think people will already have a sense of like how many different angles and aspects there are of this to be able to appreciate. And I was, as you were talking, I was making little notes of all the things that I thought were interesting. And I'll just mention a few. And first, like just to reemphasize that this show, like the kind of concept that visitors will see is that, which I was impressed by, despite having kind of been aware of Lichtenstein for a long time, I hadn't really seen kind of materials about his in-studio process. And that's a lot of what you see, like his drawings and his working methods. And they explain how he did a lot of things and how he kind of went from idea to execution. And it's, I mean, in a way it's very simple and obvious, but I was still actually a little not surprised, but I never really thought too much about kind of how the process worked. And part of it is that the final works are so kind of perfected in certain ways, or like they're so carefully done that they almost appear to, at least in some eyes, they almost appear to have just kind of arrived like that. And you wouldn't necessarily realize all of the many, many, many kind of iterations and working drawings and everything. So a big part of what you see in the show is going behind the veil, so to speak, into the studio and seeing what he did. But coming back to some of your comments. So one of the things that I was pondering was like the relationship to New York and New York City. And certainly if you kind of learn about modern contemporary art, New York is obviously very central, and yet, you know, here we are, we're well outside of New York, and this is something to appreciate. But especially in this, you know, tying into this big annual 250th anniversary that we're talking about with the Declaration of Independence and the United States and the kind of the question of American identity, I was thinking to myself, well, what is the relationship between, I mean, Lichtenstein is clearly a New York artist, born and raised, but also an American artist. And like, what about his work reflects New York City in particular? And what about it reflects the United States and sort of the overlap between those things? Like, one thing that caught my eye at the time was there was one of the pieces is inspired by some Art Deco sculpture at Rockefeller Center, which is a great monument right there in the heart of Manhattan. But then, you know, there's clearly a lot about his work that speaks to America more broadly. But I'll actually pause there. And as someone who has that geographical background and experience, I'm curious about your thoughts on like New York, America, et cetera.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think when we think about our American history, and like, if you were gonna like, well, name like aggressively American art, you know, I think Lichtenstein would be right there. But I also think it's just sort of, it survives because we can have a lot of intellectual discussion about its place in art history and who he was influenced by and who he influenced, you know, in terms of who came after him. But I really think like that the works that that live, that survive, they have a combination of beauty and consequences. They feel consequential in some way.
Yeah.
And I think that aspect of Lichtenstein is particularly American, just because he is interrogating consumerism. There is a politic there in terms of his work being early to the table and in terms of being essentially a male feminist, which is a term that's been sort of defanged and criticized and can it even exist and what would that mean? But yeah, he sort of pulls back the shroud in a way, more so than even Warhol and Richter, I would say, like in terms of that political gender-based material. Along, of course, with his formal innovations.
Yeah.
It's that combination, it comes back to simple things, it comes back to form and function the same way, literature comes back to like plot and character, and if you do the cardinal elements really well, the culinary arts, do I really care, about your foie gras, or can you make Lee a really good omelet? There's stuff that we can have very highbrow, educated, discussions about, but undergirding that, there has to be again that baseline excellence and that idea that the art has attained some combination of beauty and consequences. And again, to quote Dave Hickey again, beautiful works survive sans virtue, whereas virtuous works sans beauty do not. Lichtenstein's work seems like a work that has already survived quite a long time and will continue to do so in the future in myriad ways, because it is so invested in just like the perpetuation of capitalism and consumerism, and it has those political elements, and it is dipping down into the good, bad, and otherwise of America.
Yeah. Oh, really, really interesting. Well, my next note about one of the comments that kind of caught my ear a moment ago, thinking about, I'm going to try and tie these things together, thinking about kind of generations and the passage of time. And first part has to do with Lichtenstein's career. He had fortunate long life, long career, a lot of work, many decades. But and as someone who, like, I've thought about how artists' work gets represented in kind of, let's say, short survey classes or long survey classes, which we know about, or even just kind of canonical overviews, there's something about how, whether you're in art or literature or music, like if you have a big hit at some point, like that's sort of your thing, your identity. And you've like the pop artists early 60s, they had these huge impact with basically pop art itself, which was like very novel, I guess, at early 1960s. And then, but of course, kept going for decades. Fast forwarding ahead to the second part of this question or comment, which is about, you mentioned teaching the younger kids who have no memory of even the 1990s, much less the 1960s. They look back at it and how they see Lichtenstein. So I'm just reflecting, and I reflected when I saw the show as well. I mean, I wasn't born when pop art came out, and I understand that at the time, if you were a gallery goer in the early 1960s, it was a little shocking to see pop art in a gallery. And I can try to imagine that, but I can't quite experience it. And so I'm thinking about those younger generations who are now fully digital, looking back at the 1990s and trying to think about what would they see in Lichtenstein.
Yeah, I think that since you were kind of talking about American identity too, I remember the first piece you published of mine was back in 2019, and it was sort of about like a Bruce Springsteen song, The Hitter, which is about a boxer and how that ties into American identity. And he's a person who had a long life and a long career and many works and has written about and sang about American identity. I also published a piece with you about Philip Roth, and his novel Deception. And he's another artist who was very much, and he was sort of, kind of concurrent with the pop art movement. But again, long life, long career, many works, very much writing about identity, in his case, Jewish American identity, but also working class identity. And as they're both from New Jersey and I'm from New Jersey, and sort of thinking about that and trying to connect that to what you're saying about Lichtenstein, it's like these people who have made an imprint upon the culture, right? And so obviously, and the word imprint with Lichtenstein comes to mind. But yeah, there was a certain ferocity to them that did not abate, that if anything has grown as they've become older artists. If you look at Philip Roth's later works, if you look at Springsteen up until this day, there's a sort of unrelentingness, and again, when I said like students being curious about the period that preceded them, they're really curious about what it was like. They're looking at me as somebody in my 40s and saying, essentially, what was it like to live simultaneously to Tupac and Kurt Cobain? You know, being alive in the world, alive in the culture, the people and things that they only know as t-shirts, And then you're sort of saying, well, like, let's look back at, like, you know, a period before ours and what was Lichtenstein saying in the mid 60s. And you can say that essentially about any artist, you know, and again, especially those who live to have that kind of long life, long career, many works. You think about Picasso. I came across a stand-up comedian recently, this guy, Joe List, and he was kind of talking about how, like, we forget, like, Picasso seems so canonical, seems right. like such an established figure from a world that came well before us, those of us who are alive now, living in 2026 and the internet and yada, yada, yada. But, Picasso lived concurrent to the Honda Civic and the first four Led Zeppelin records, you know? So, yeah, that idea of, like, situating people within their own time, like, here is what Lichtenstein meant when it came out. Like, yeah, no, I was not there when Philip Roth, you know, released Portnoy's Complaint or when Bruce Springsteen's Born to Run came out. So I can't have the experience of, like, what it was like when those things were birthed in the world.
Yeah.
But I, like, again, the things that last sort of carry this consequentiality and this aesthetic brilliance, this vividness, this sort of undeniable singular uniqueness that just sort of sets them apart from other things, you know, to sort of a simple sounding distillation.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's really well said. I mean, this is like, okay, this is like the most banal possible observation, but I'm going to say it anyway, which is that, like, I'm sure I know that when pop or whatever came out, the reaction was predominantly about the shock of the new, as they say, but now that it's decades old, like, that can't possibly, like, there's no way that we can have that shock of the new anymore with it. So whatever these other aspects are really, really comes to the fore.
Although I do, just to say one thing, I do think newness sort of, because Robert Rauschenberg was featured a little bit in there as well, kind of in terms of, like, as you wrote about as well, like, he's such a sort of presence in the contemporary art scene and is one of those people who's kind of concurrent to Lichtenstein and is sort of like a big name in the art world. And he had this kind of idea of, like, the 40-year cycle, you know, and after 40 years passes, you can kind of, like, bring something back without seeming derivative. The things kind of in the art world and in, I think, the other arts as well, that there's this sort of 40-year cycle where time needs to pass. Like, we, you know, when I was growing up, people would say, you can't even judge a novel until it's been out for 50 years, you know? So, yeah, I think that's an interesting component as well. Like, yes, you can't have it fresh out new, but it kind of becomes new again after significant amount of time after, and again, it has to be at least one generation, though, has to have passed before a different generation can kind of see it anew without the baggage that is accrued in terms of its immediate reaction.
Oh, no, that's so interesting. I mean, I'm thinking I'm coming up with all these associations about music and so forth, but I'll have to say this for our next podcast conversation, because I think we should shift gears. And in part two of this podcast, we will now discuss a couple of recent works by our guests. And I'll just say that, so there is a work of fiction titled Put Your Kids to Work, which is published in Socrates on the Beach, and that is online. And then also a piece of criticism, which will be forthcoming in the next Athenaeum Review, that discusses in particular two works of fiction and this theme of the literature. Now, we've actually discussed the right word here, the literature of masculinity, manhood, maleness, men, whatever the right word is. But I thought, maybe why don't we start by talking about the work of criticism and this question of the literature of masculinity or whatever, how you might comment on that broadly and whatever you might want to add in about the works that you were in particular writing about as a critic.
Yeah, I mean, I'm writing about a contemporary author, Jordan Castro, who's published a couple of novels and is sort of, you know, somebody who's been written about, who's been discussed as you know, trying to essay contemporary masculinity and what's going on with it.
Yeah.
And then also Arthur Schnitzler, turn of the century, you know, best known for A Dream Story, which was adapted as Eyes Wide Shut by Stanley Kubrick, and just sort of two different artists, two different writers about 100 years apart writing about the insecurities of being a man in the world. And it's such a sort of exhausting topic in the pop culture these days. And in terms of, like, if you read about the literary world, and if you read about, you know, you go on like people's Substacks there, and you know, and the Atlantic and the New Yorker, and every other week it seems like somebody is, you know, kind of trying to parse this idea of like, well, what's the problem with men, and why are men not reading enough, and men should read more, and this is toxic masculinity, and this is kind of okay over here, and the straight white male in the world, and privilege, and how to write about what it is to be a man. For all, like, that sounds, like you were saying, it sounds in some ways banal, but yeah, it's also sort of like an essential thing to deal with, you know, as we deconstruct gender, separate gender from biological sex. So yeah, I think my piece kind of looks at again, the works that will last and the works that sustain.
Yeah.
And though I see talent in Jordan Castro's book, particularly his first books, the novelist, a little bit more so than A Muscle Man from 2025. I see humor, which I think is really important. You know, I think there's a sort of humorlessness in the culture these days, and that there's certain people who are allowed to take themselves seriously, or write about themselves seriously, and that, you know, any worrying about men for a long time was considered like, oh, it's a joke, you're so privileged, there's no way you get to complain, there's no way you get to have a sort of identity politics of your own. And that's been, you know, kind of refuted lately. So I kind of wanted to take the opportunity to kind of weigh in and assess these works of fiction, and, you know, how certain works can be artful in, you know, engaging with political issues in the world. And yeah, sort of looking at how enduring and how artful something seems like it'll be versus, like, is this a response that is a little bit reactionary, and that is a little bit hung up on things that will not have a particularly long shelf life? You know, I'm commenting in particular, which in Schnitzler's case, about a very short novella length text, even smaller, maybe more of a novelette length text, called Lieutenant Goosel. And it's sort of about, you know, a bourgeois upper class officer who starts the story at the opera, and he has an interaction with a commoner where he is insulted, and he sort of backs down from a fight, and then his, like, his downward spiral in this sort of stream of consciousness. It's essentially considered, you know, like the first stream of consciousness narrative in German literature. And yeah, we get to go into his head and see sort of a, you know, century hence version of the things that we hear about now, you know, like insecurity, toxic masculinity, violence, aggression, being overly concerned with what others think of you, you know, and being so concerned about your reputation and about your perception that you turn to really at times heinous things. And yeah, and this kind of just dovetailed in my mind into, like, our concerns about young men. And again, I think about my students and read the writing of my students. And hey, I have a nephew, and I, you know, see people growing up online and seeing them influenced by the things that erode our attention span and the things that promote, you know, whatever we're calling it these days, misinformation or disinformation, and reinforce the ugliest forms of tribalism and misogyny.
Yeah.
And I always think that, like, exposure to the arts is sort of the best way to combat that.
Yeah.
And I know we're going to talk about my fiction piece as well, which was, yeah, in some ways, is there a response as well to, like, you know, is there a way we can have sort of a masculine take on something that is healthy and honest, and it's written from the point of view of a father, and it's written in a style that was influenced by a lot of, you know, well-known contemporary writers, but trying to put my own kind of male spin on it. So I guess that's how those two works link together in my mind anyway.
Yeah. No, I wanted to, and this I'm going to attempt again to tie a couple of those themes together in this follow-up question, which is, you touched a little bit on your students and teaching, and as with our previous topic, I suppose my question might be whether either in the authors that your students particularly respond to or engage with or feel seem excited by or inspired by, you know, if there are particular authors or maybe representations of manhood, let's say, that you think are worth mentioning. And then I also wanted to tie that back. We mentioned a couple of the other articles, that things that you've written for Athenaeum Review, among others, which are great and which I'll put links to and which everyone should read if they haven't already. But aside from the authors that you're talking about in this newest article, and if there are other authors that you might want to highlight as offering particularly worthwhile or valuable or kind of engaging visions of masculinity or manhood, if that makes sense.
Oh, wow. That's such a good question, Ben. Yeah, I think I would say that the masterpieces, the masterworks that, you know, really kind of get people excited. I'm always surprised at kind of what works with students and what doesn't.
Yeah.
There are things that I would think they would respond to that they don't. And then there are things where I go, oh, this doesn't seem like their cup of tea. So yeah, this pretty much every semester I teach at UT Arlington, and every summer we kind of do like there's a professor, Catherine Warren, who runs like something called the Big Read, where, you know, various students, faculty, friends, whoever, you know, is interested is invited. And we kind of break down like a larger, longer, famous text. And that's, you know, we are this summer covering Roberto Bolaño's 2666.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we kind of just had our first, you know, book club or whatever you want to call it last week. And it was a really big turnout, you know, and it was a lot of, you know, people of all, you know, ages and education levels. And it's a work that is, you know, very complex and seems very difficult, but people had no, you know, dearth of opinions. And that is a work about, amongst other things, the killing of women, you know, the Juarez killings from the late 90s and early 2000s, right on the border of Texas and Mexico, just south of El Paso. But yeah, there's something about that work that has that quality that I'm going to keep coming back to. The combination of the consequential and the aesthetically engaging, interesting, resonant. There's something there to it that harkens back to the Brothers Karamazov or Ulysses or these other works that we've read in this, you know, kind of every summer book club. And I think that's one of the things that universities and you were talking about as we kind of came on here about reading Ulysses, reading the Odyssey out loud down at Deep Vellum in Deep Vellum. Yeah. And they're having this kind of every week where, again, people show up. You sit in a circle, you read this really, really famous, really, really old thing that's being made into a movie by Christopher Nolan. So it's just like, okay, let's combine these things. So yeah, I think it's the stuff, it's the big time real stuff that lasts, you know. My students do respond surprisingly well to, you know, Ray Carver and Ernest Hemingway. And they're interested in these, especially in my creative writing classes, they're interested in the iceberg theory. They're interested in Carver's, you know, portrayal of working class relations. And the gender relations there, they don't know what it was like to live in rural America in the 80s, but they're interested in, like, this is how men and women talked to each other. And they're interested in their men and women-ness.
Yeah.
In a time where the LGBT community wasn't so well represented and where heteronormativity was so instantiated as to, you know, as to be almost undeniable, and how, you know, that's not that long ago, you know? And I think they're interested in learning about, you know, history in general. I think that because history is sort of skewed and we're living in a world where people have a harder and harder time discerning the truth, with the capital T truth, that when they are taken back into the world of mid-20th century America, 19th century America, and we read Emily Dickinson, and, you know, you kind of got to give it that like historical context of, okay, we're in New England, we're in this particular year, what were the rights of women and men in that period? That seems to be where they're most engaged, where there's a combination of it, the historical and the real. Like, again, I keep coming back to that notion of the real, because the real seems so much less accessible than it used to be.
Yeah.
And because we are bombarded with these in real time, highly opinionated, you know, it's harder to get facts because it's immediately given commentary. And the novel or the artwork or the symphony, you know, or the album, is something that exists in a particular, you know, place and time, and that you can look at it, and it has a little bit of, it's a bit of a readout. It's something you can kind of touch and hold. And I'm always surprised at this kind of like summer book club a book read, like everybody shows up with the physical book.
Yeah.
You know, and I noticed that as well at Deep Vellum with reading The Odyssey. Yeah, people have the tangible object in their hands. They're not reading off a phone. They're not reading off a laptop. They're not reading off a device. And of course, the book is itself a form of technology, but it's one, it might be the best form of technology, to use a really kind of cheesy line. But yeah, I think the more something is engaged with the tangible and the real, the more of a reaction that I tend to get from students. Again, whether that is music, whether that is the arts. And yeah, it's one thing to like hear about Jackson Pollock or look at a screenshot of a Jackson Pollock. And it's a really different thing to be in the room with it and be able to see the textures and walk up to, you know, 1 inch away from it. So that's something I always encourage my students to do. Like, all right, here's this thing that I'm going to display on the overhead projector, but it is, you know, vastly different from what that thing is like when you're in the room looking at it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm glad you mentioned a lot of those things. And well, I have so many follow-ups, but instead I'm going to shift again and just say, and let's talk about this, the story. Put Your Kids to Work is been published in Socrates on the Beach. And let me just start by asking if you want to kind of introduce it and kind of give readers, listeners a sense before they go in and read it.
Yeah, I guess I would call it a novelette. It's the longest work of fiction that I've published. Socrates on the Beach has been around for a little while now. Its main editor is the writer Greg Gierke. They are out of Brooklyn. And it's first person POV story written from the perspective of a painter, an artist who's had some degree of success, but is dealing with the long tail of trauma that stems from his being sent to an asylum in Connecticut by his parents when he was a teenager for essentially being of non-heteronormative sexuality, you know. Mm-hmm. And he considers himself someone who used to be gay, like mm-hmm. who now considers himself the last, he says that the last term or label that he used to describe himself was heteroflexible. And he has one child, a daughter, and he's had a lot of success, but he is also, and he's, you know, he's kind of the genius who's a bit exhausting. And he's exhausting because he's exhausted by life and he's considering getting off the ride, so to speak. And then what that means for a father with a young child, what that means for somebody who on the surface is considered very successful. And it's sort of, you know, yeah, it goes into his sort of perspective on the world. And it's written in a sort of fragmented style that was influenced by Rachel Cusk and Jenny Offal, and particularly Helen DeWitt, who's a friend of mine in the writing community, who I published an interview with her and Ilya Gridnev, their most recent book, mm-hmm. Your Name Here, came out. And yeah, she has a short story called Climbers in Some Trick, her short story collection, that was sort of like, well, can I do this from the perspective of somebody from my generation who grew up in the 90s art scene in New York City and what that was like? Because, you know, and again, I'm drawing from a little bit of my experience as, you know, working class bridge and tunnel New Jersey guy, you know, from that period. And yeah, that's sort of the background of it. And it's a piece I'm really proud of. I think it really holds up. And I think it's a work that evokes and immerses. And that's what I look for in literature anyway, or in writing in general. I want a work that kind of evokes thoughts and feelings. And I want a work that immerses the reader in a particular time and place. And hopefully I've done that with Put Your Kids to Work out of Socrates on the Beach, which is, yeah, it's a really good literary journal and really good, you know, just sort of publishing the kind of stuff that's not being published, let's say, in the New Yorker. Not that the New Yorker never publishes anything worthwhile.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. Well, this, I guess, in a way is it's a very basic question, so you'll have to forgive me, but as we discussed, or I mean, it's on your site, it's in your bio. I mean, you have experience as a critic, as a scholar, a professor. You in the classroom, in wearing many or multiple different hats, thinking about this question of what is art, what is the artist, what does it mean to be an artist making art, you know, all those great things that we think about and teach about. So my question is, as a writer of fiction, do you, like, when you go in and write a work of fiction such as this, do you think about those questions differently than, say, if you're lecturing in a classroom or if you're writing criticism, or if it kind of flows in, or just what you might have to say about that?
Well, I would say, yeah, I'd say I try not to think about it. Okay. I would say that my my creative writing, like you, they're two completely different hats. If you're you're going to go with the hats thing, yeah, and I think
we don't have to go with the hats thing, but however you put it.
I think you don't want a whole lot of bleed over. You know, I think that, you know, it might be inevitable to some extent, but I don't really think so. I think you have to, in order to be a good creator, you have to put the critic persona aside as fully and as completely as you can. I think, and a lot of people have talked about that over the years, from David Foster Wallace to Bob Dylan, just that they are two different things.
Yeah.
Thinking critically about something versus creating something is not the same thing. The mind you use to write the thing, to create the thing, to birth the thing, is even a different mind than the one you use to revise the thing.
Yeah.
So yeah, they're two very different hats, two very different muscles. So yeah, and I think they're good. They're best separated on the plate, you know, so to speak. Yeah, you don't want to scramble them together. You want to come into creative work with the creative brain, then take a deep breath, put the creative work in, you know, and again, people have used this analogy for years. You put it in the drawer for a while, and then you come back to it with different eyes. And of course, it helps, you know, to have other people's eyes. Most people are receiving some form of feedback on their art, whether they are a painter or a musician or a poet or a novelist or a short story writer. You know, there are very few works, you know, that come out fully formed based purely on quote unquote inspiration. But you need to dwell in that inspiration place, bereft of the revision mind, the self-critique mind, the mind that you use to critique the works of others. And yeah, you've got to keep that objectivity for later in the process.
Yeah. Well, this is another, I'll just call it a basic question that I'm sure I can't imagine how many times it may have come up in the classroom. But so if one is reading a work of fiction or I suppose drama or anything, you know, let's say like a naive reaction at first might be if there's a character that says something or thinks something and then someone says, oh, well, the author says this and this and this. Well, but wait a minute, it's actually, that's what the character is saying, but that's not what, you know, the author might have an ironic perspective on that, or the character might be set up as a foil or something like that. So whether in this particular novelette or otherwise, one of the things that I imagine that you do as a writer of fiction is you have character and you have that character has a perspective and then you, the author, have a different perspective. I wondered if there's anything that you would want to say about that in reference to this piece or more generally as a writer of fiction.
I guess I would say that you used the right word there, that they're characters are characters. They're not representations, you know, and I'm all for looking at things through a more semiotic lens and signifier and signified. But yeah, I think you have to make distinctions, which, you know, are again, they seem pretty basic, but yeah, there's the author and then there's the narrator and then there's the characters, and that these things are concentric circles of a sort. They certainly influence each other. But yeah, I think we are far too quick for the most part these days to try to associate the two. And people want to know about the author and their politics or their group membership or what they said about whatever issue of the day or whatever representational community they are or not a part of, as opposed to looking at the work of art as a work of art. And that's sort of used to be considered the bare minimum. That was like the barrier that you had to overcome. That was the baseline entry point of just like, no, we're going to distinguish the art from the artist. That used to be a given that great art, you know, could be made by all sorts of people. Sometimes you don't even know the person. Like, you know, if you look at Homer, was Homer one person? Was Homer male? Yeah. Was Homer female? Was Homer blind? Was Homer more than one person? That used to be a given. But yeah, there's this kind of rush to conflate art and artist. Now, again, you could call my position traditionalistic. You could say like, hey, I, you know, hey, and I'm not telling anybody how to, you know, spend their money, or like, I don't want to support art made by that person because I don't like their politics, or because they said a thing that I didn't like, or because they were accused of a thing, you know, or they committed a crime. That's any individual's perspective about how they spend their time and money. But
I'm
going to look at Moby Dick as Moby Dick. And then later on, we can talk about, you know, Herman Melville and whether or not he was a good enough guy to his wife. You know, I'm going to look at Philip Roth's novels and Bruce Springsteen's songs as novels and as songs. And then later on, we can talk about, you know, who they vote for. So yeah, for me anyway, it's I guess I would say that we need to at least consider more seriously that people are growing up in a world where they haven't been taught how essential it is to separate the art from the artist.
Yeah, yeah. Well, finally, I was like to ask at the end if, aside from what we've just been discussing, if they're looking ahead to the future in terms of current or upcoming projects or plans, that if there's anything that you're working on or will be working on that you might want to mention for people to look forward to.
Yeah, I mean, we are recording this in May of 26. So I am, you know, relieved a little bit of my teaching duties, which take up so much of my time during the spring and fall semester. So yeah, I am working on a short novel or novella. And yeah, I'm not one of those people who likes to talk a lot about work that's still in progress. But it is in progress, and I am working on a fiction manuscript and, you know, submitting existing manuscripts as well. So yeah, as much as I've published a lot of, you know, reviews and interviews and critical works, yeah, my love when it comes to writing is fiction. So that's where I'm going to be spending as much time as I can this summer.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, I look forward to seeing that when it comes. And we've been speaking today with Sean Hooks. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, Ben.
And this is the Athenaeum Review podcast, and there's more at athenaeumreview.com.